Welcome to another episode of Systematic Geekology. This is a space where we seek to create and cultivate healthy conversations between those things we geek out on and the philosophical and theological questions that often arise out of our fandoms. Like, what does it mean to be human? What makes a hero? What makes a villain? How do the stories and narratives we geek out on shape how we live in the world? We are your priest to the geeks. We aren't all ordained, but we see ourselves as mediators at the intersection of geek culture and going deeper in our faith. We don't always have to agree, but we do respect each other, and we see everyone as a beloved child of God. Everyone geeks out on something, so come geek out with us and enjoy the show.
You're listening to an Anna's Owl Ministries podcast.
Hello, geekologists! Welcome! This is Systematic Geekology. We are the priests of the geeks, and I am one of your geekologists, pop culture enthusiasts, Kevin Schaefer, and I am here with X-Men connoisseur, esteemed geekologist, Andy Walsh. Andy, how are you tonight?
I am doing very well. Thank you for that generous introduction, Kevin. How are you?
I'm doing really well. It's fine. I know this isn't a what we're geeking out on feature, but it's something I have to tell about you real quick. There's a podcaster and YouTube poster I've been following for years who's rewatching every MCU movie and Fox X-Men movie every week leading up to Doomsday, and he started a blog about it. It's fascinating. So it's called myyearofmarvel.blogspot.com. I had to plug that for you because I think you would really enjoy it, because he's doing both like each movie and then comic tie-ins and that kind of thing. And it's a well-written blog. I really appreciate his perspective. So Hector Navarro is the author of it.
Excellent. That does sound right up my alley. And maybe I will try to watch along.
It's pretty cool. Yeah. And he's also crafted a really interesting viewing order, too. That's not order of how they were released. It's fascinating.
Okay. Yeah. And while we're not geeking out on things, I'm not geeking out on Will Rose, our co-host, teased that he might be interviewing Al Ewing on his Thor podcast. So I am excited / not excited to hear or not hear that interview that may or may not be happening.
May or may not be. We'll have to see. One that we did drop was an interview with Rob Venditti, who I can call a friend. I've known him for years. He's one of the first comic creators I ever interviewed. So Will and I just interviewed him for this podcast. So you can go check that out. But
very nice.
Well, and I say all of this because this is a very comic book centric episode. So I had to put a little tease there. Andy, I'm really excited for this episode. We are going to be talking about indie comic book icons. So obviously people like you and me, you know, I'm wearing a Batman shirt right now. You have your Xavier logo in the background as always. You know, we talk DC and Marvel all the time, but you and I are also big fans, enthusiasts of indie comic books. And so what we're doing in this episode is talking about three iconic characters from indie comic books. And in particular, these are characters that we find relatable. So not just the ones that have their place in pop culture, but ones that we have a more personal connection to. So I'm really excited to see what we have picked here. And this will be a really fun discussion. And before we get started, first off, I wanted to thank James Barrett. Thank you so much for the support, James. You rock. We really appreciate it. And if you want to learn more about how you can support Systematic Geekology, or if you're first time here and you just want to look into the show a little bit more, check out the show notes. You can see in the description there ways where you can support us. You can follow us on all our social media pages and all over the internet, wherever you get your podcasts. But check that out. That will give you some good information on how best to help us out, because we really appreciate listeners like all of you. So, Andy, I'm really excited for this one. So let's get right into it. Before we share our top three characters, what's kind of your background with independent comic books? Because again, you and I talk DC and Marvel a ton, but I'm curious kind of when you started reading books that are outside the big two.
Yeah, so that made this challenging to kind of go through the list, because I realized that while, you know, I've read a few, you know, non-Marvel and DC books, most of that has happened in my adult years. And so, you know, I don't know that these are necessarily formative characters in the same way that, you know, like Superman and Batman and Multiple Man and some of the other people that I talk about regularly that, you know, I encountered as a kid growing up and sort of imprinted on, right? Those were easy names to come up with, but you know, my independent comic reading definitely started more as a young adult. Right, so read comics in junior high and high school. You know, mostly X-Men, because my friend got me into X-Men comics. I'd read some like Superman and Batman collections from the library before that, like 1950s and 1960s, kind of black and white reprints. You know, giant, massive book doorstop collections of Batman and Superman comics. And, you know, I remember Image, you know, launching in the early 90s as I was reading comics. You know, as an X-Men reader, it was hard to not be somewhat aware of the Image launch. But for whatever reason, the titles just didn't grab me at the time. The one Image book that I did pick up at launch was Tribe, the Larry Stroman book, because Larry Stroman had been the artist on Peter David's X-Factor when that launched. And he left that to go. He was like in a second wave of artists who started up at Image. So that wasn't one of the launch titles. That was one of their like second wave titles. And they published all of one issue of Tribe at Image. Issues 2 and 3 eventually came out from another publisher. And then that was, I believe it, or that's certainly all I ever read. And I, you know, followed it for a while after that. But yeah, then in college and after college, I kind of got out of comics for a bit, just not having the time and or disposable income in the same way. And then got back into it pretty much, you know, because Peter David came back to writing Multiple Man. And then, you know, was starting to get more into listening to podcasts and reading blogs. And there was a lot more ways to engage with the fan community at the time. And so that introduced me to a bunch of other books that I didn't know about otherwise. And I started paying more attention to, okay, so, and, you know, there were also more opportunities for writers and artists to do both Marvel and DC work and creator-owned work or other independent work. So I just started paying attention more to who are the creators that I like and then following them in other things, people like Kieran Gillen and Cy Spurrier and so forth. So, yeah, I'd be hard-pressed to say what my first one was, but we'll talk about some of my, you know, favorites that I came across in that process as we go along here. But yeah, so that was kind of when I started. So mid 2000s, like the first decade of this century, is when I started getting into things. And yeah, and then just been kind of following different recommendations from different podcasts, or now, you know, this including you and this podcast and different blogs. And then also just, like I said, following the creators that I first encountered in the Marvel or DC world that I was interested in.
Yeah, and I'm really glad you said that, because it's been such a fascinating evolution with indie comics. Like you said, in the 90s, that was when Image started. But, you know, I was a toddler and young kid then, so I was not reading Spawn, you know, that. But what's really interesting with my comics journey is that I started really collecting in late high school and then in college, because in college there was a comic book store, right? I went to NC State and there was a store right there on Hillsborough Street. And I had some disposable income, and so I was able to collect books regularly there. And that was literally a prime time for independent books, because this was in the like Image revival boom, where books like Saga and then later Paper Girls and a lot of Jeff Lemire stuff and so many titles were coming out from a lot of creators creators who had been established at Marvel and DC and were now doing their own creator-owned work. And so these books were really, I mean, like, it was, they were the kind of stuff that weren't, you know, looked down on. I mean, the comics have this kind of all the back and forth of like, oh, you still read comics as an adult kind of thing. But like with a lot of these titles, it wasn't really that stigma there as much. Yeah, these were kind of the really cool, more progressive stories that, you know, a lot of, you know, young adults and older adults were reading and had a mass appeal. And so, yeah, I was getting into it around then because growing up, yeah, I mean, I mainly had graphic novels that I would get either at the library or, you know, for birthdays and Christmases, but those were all superhero oriented. And so I, when I got to college and I was collecting more regularly, it was a great time for, independent comic books. And so that was kind of, and it just kind of grew from there. And, you know, my, as far as like going to the comic shops week to week, you know, that's got like kind of fizzled out. I collect more trades and stuff now, but I've read, you know, hundreds of different independent titles over the years, and avenues like Humble Bundle have given me access to a lot of those as well. So there's just a plethora of stories out there. There's, you know, the medium has really evolved, and there's a lot of different genres within indie books. And some of my favorite creators are all of them. So, yeah. So anyway, it's been a really interesting evolution for me as a reader and just for comics as a whole. You know, to see how much indie books have evolved in the last, I would say, especially 15 years or so. And I think it's still growing. And now we have more adaptations of these stories in other mediums. So it's really fascinating to see.
Yeah. As you were talking, it was coming back to me. I think one of, if not the first books that got me to branch out was Morning Glories. So I, you know, my wife and I were watching Lost at the time, and it was kind of pitched as not exactly the same, right? It's not a desert island or anything like that, but it's a kind of long form mystery storytelling kind of thing. And one of the bloggers, Paul O'Brien, a longtime X-Men reviewer and blogger, was into it because, you know, it had a similar kind of dense long form plotting like the X-Men. And ironically, that book got to about 50 issues out of a planned 100 and just petered out. So we were all, you know, a lot of us were kind of heavily invested in these very dense plots and mystery that we will never ever figure out what the end of that was. So you know, you take your chances with some of these indie books as to how they're going to turn out. And you know, and like I said, Tribe, you know, was a book I was really invested in for all of three issues.
And that's the thing too, is like, yeah, we I think we've had this session on Saga before. It's like, I hope it gets to the planned number of issues that Brian K. Vaughan and Fiona Staples have for it. But yeah, we'll see how it all plays out, because we've been on this journey for years now. Yeah. And that, you know, that is the, because it's like with superhero books, it's, you know, they're meant to be long lasting, but there's not really a definitive end for Batman, Spider-Man, Superman, Wonder Woman. It's more, you get, you know, different eras with the character, different creators. But with a set established story, in a creator owned world, yeah, you, are very devoted to it and you want to see it through to the end. And you hope that the creators are able to, carry it through and get the proper ending.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, Andy, I'm very excited to hear your pick. So let's start with you with your number three. So this is a character that is somewhat iconic in indie comics, but even more so that's relatable to you. So what is your number three pick?
Yeah. So for number three, I went with Alex from Alex plus Ada, or Alex and Ada.
Okay. Yeah.
This was a series I ran something like 15 or 20 issues, I think it was. From Jonathan Luna and Sarah Vaughan, in that kind of early period that I started reading these different indie books. So mid 2000s, maybe later in that decade. And you know, it's a story about a man who falls in love with a robot, right? So it's a sci-fi story about a world where you can purchase a human looking and acting robot to do household chores or be a caregiver for, you know, a loved one who might need that kind of care, or you know, all kinds of different, you know, all the things you can imagine that you might need to hire a person to do. You can now purchase or rent or what have you, all these different robots. And so Alex is sort of roped into getting one of these by some well-meaning friends and or family who don't want him to be lonely and think that, you know, he needs somebody in his life, whether that's romantic or otherwise. Just that, you know, they're worried about him being lonely. And so this female robot Ada enters his life somewhat by surprise to him. And over the, you know, fairly early on, he starts, you know, worrying about things like autonomy, and, you know, learns that there are robots who have become autonomous and are fighting for robot rights and so forth. And so he ultimately goes down the route of going through the you know, jailbreaking process, essentially, to make Ada an autonomous robot. And, you know, what follows then is how their relationship develops. The you know, the trouble, obviously, that they, you can imagine that they might get into with the company and the government and all these different things, the tensions over robot rights. In some ways, it there were echoes of some of the same themes in The Electric State last year, that film with Chris Pratt and Millie Bobby Brown. And obviously, you know, all of our conversations these days seem to center around AI and, you know, is AI conscious? Will it be conscious? You know, should we, what kind of rights should we give to these large language models and so forth? So it was a very, very prescient book in that regard. But yeah, and, you know, how much do I relate to Alex? You know, somewhat. I mean, he's definitely, you know, he was kind of an every man kind of character. You know, just sort of going about a typical job, a typical sort of middle-class suburban life, and kind of gets caught up in trying to figure out how to be an ally. And, you can decide for yourself, how well I do in these different things, but, you know, certainly something that, I would like to be better at is, you know, caring not just about my own needs and my own concerns, but the things that affect other people disproportionately compared to myself. And, you know, I think there's something to be said about a character for all of his other flaws and whatnot, that, you know, kind of the core choice of the book was, you know, he had the opportunity to decide between his own will and his own wants and his own gratification, or those of someone else, in particular those of the agency of a character or a person who is female coded. We can talk about, you know, how gender applies to robots and whatnot, but, you know, certainly presents in a very traditional female fashion, and he chooses, you know, her agency. And I think that's a worthwhile kind of story to explore. So that's why I wound up picking that one.
Excellent pick. I know that title. Unfortunately, it's not one I've read yet, but like, I who are the creators on that one?
Yeah, so it's Jonathan Luna and Sarah Vaughan.
Gotcha. Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, there's a lot of good sci-fi comics I've read over the years, and that's certainly on my list. But excellent pick. I mean, like you said, it's so relevant today with the rise of AI and how rapidly things are changing. And yeah, I mean, there's a lot of Jeff Lemire stories that I've read too that have similar themes. And so, yeah, it's a great pick.
Yeah, Descendant and Ascendant were definitely in my contention for, you know, with a similar kind of theme. So
that Descender is fantastic. Like, I mean, I was thinking through some of the Lemire books, and I love those stories. There wasn't any sticking out to me in terms of like, oh, I really relate to that character.
Yeah.
They're wonderful characters. It was just like, I just love the stories. But yeah, that's a great book though.
Yeah, same. Even though one of them was named Andy, it was just like, I'm sure that any of these are me.
Right. Oh, yeah, no, I mean, like, there's ones, it's like, okay, I have a little bit of a trait there, but yeah, a lot of these stories, it's more, I'm just attracted to the story itself more than, oh, I relate to this person.
Yeah.
But yeah. Awesome. So, well, great pick, Andy. So, yeah.
I was just going to ask what your number three was, so go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. So my number three is actually a character I was introduced to through a movie, ironically, which because, you know, at a young age, too. I remember when I first saw the Guillermo del Toro Hellboy movies. I had to convince my parents to let me order it on Netflix back in the days when Netflix sent you discs, before streaming. But I asked if they could add that to the queue, and they were terrified that it was some kind of like satanic, you know, cult movie. And I was like, no, it's just it's a PG-13 superhero movie. But from the first time I saw that movie, and even though I read the comics later on, I was really gravitated toward the character of Abe Sapien, who in the movie is played by Doug Jones. While the Del Toro movies are very much a distinctive vision from the director, and yeah, they're different from the comics, I would say the characters themselves are pretty brought to life from the pages. I mean, they're a lot of the same personality traits and quirks and everything. And so Abe Sapien is this creature from the Black Lagoon type partner to Hellboy, who works with him in the BPRD, the Bureau for Paranormal Research and Defense. And he's sort of the more calm, resonating spirit to Hellboy's more gung-ho and rash, you know, fighter mentality. Abe Sapien is the more bookworm. He has a good relationship with the professor. And I just love the aesthetic of the character, both in the comics and in the movie. So it was a character who really stuck out to me early on in that movie. I love Doug Jones' performance. And then later on when I read the comics, because of course that's how Hellboy originated in the Dark Horse comics created by Mike Mignola, and Abe Sapien, I think first appeared in the BPRD, but then he got his own book later on, which I actually read the first volume of not too long ago and really enjoyed it. And, you know, so you're seeing Abe go on a solo mission, and he kind of doubts himself at first, but is able to be the hero there. I always just really like the character as someone who is, you know, a really faithful, loyal sidekick, but also a hero within his own right. He has intelligence, he has empathy. There's a humorous element in the Del Toro films that I really liked. And yeah, this was just a character that I always was really fascinated by. And again, the whole creature from the Black Lagoon amphibian aspect to him was just such a cool image. And it looks great in the comics. And so, I have a big collection of Hellboy stuff from a Humble Bundle. I've got a lot of the books in physical media as well, but I have like Hellboy, BPRD, and Abe Sapien, all in Humble Bundle there. And it's great just going through those stories. And, there's not too much to say. It's just, I think about myself like at work and stuff like that, and in situations, and I don't know, I feel like I try to be that more calming presence, especially when things get heated or when someone is doing something rash. Not that I don't have those tendencies, you know, in certain situations, but generally I'm kind of the one who can take a step back, help keep everyone level headed, and kind of move at that pace. And so, you know, Abe Sapien is very much that kind of guy. So just an all around cool dude, one of my favorite fantasy creatures in comics and in fiction. It is an interesting one that it was first introduced to me as, you know, like I said, a middle schooler through a movie, but that instantly stuck out to me. And later on, as I got into the comics, I loved him just as much there.
Very cool.
So Andy, I don't know if you have any like background with the Hellboy or with the comics or anything like that. Or with it.
Yeah. So I also learned about Hellboy through that first movie. An excellent movie, possibly my favorite Del Toro movie, because it's got, you know, it's not all horror. It's got the, and fantasy. It's got some sci-fi and, you know, some Indiana Jones-esque Nazi fighting. And there's a lot to like there. Ron Perlman is fantastic as Hellboy, and Doug Jones as Abe Sapien, you know, is another standout. Now, why do I hear David Hyde Pierce's voice in my head with Abe Sapien? Am I completely inventing that, or was it Doug Jones doing the like physical performance and David Hyde Pierce providing the voice? Or am I just hallucinating?
That's a really good question. I'm gonna look up. I could swear it was Doug Jones doing both, but that now has me very curious. I just always assumed it was. But I'm gonna look that up while you're talking.
Okay. Yeah, so I learned about Hellboy from that film. I did wind up checking out some of the Hellboy comics. And you know, the second film, I haven't kept up with the later incarnations of Hellboy, but you know, those first Del Toro films were very good. And you know, the comics weren't 100% my thing, but you know, they're obviously well done, and Mike Mignola has a very distinctive art style. He drew some X-Force comics and some X-Man comics back in the day, or maybe Cable comics, or maybe both. But yeah, he, you know, in the 90s and maybe early 2000s, he was doing some X-Men work that was, you know, that was notable even then, you know, in a very distinctive style. So yeah, you know, and like you're saying, you know, everything you said about Abe Sapien, yeah, he's a great character. He's a great, one of those, you know, great sort of more straight man to Hellboy's very bombastic kind of, you know, shoot first, ask questions later kind of character.
Exactly. And I just looked it up. It is Doug Jones did the voice and the body.
Okay.
Yeah, but I could see that as a great, I mean, he does really interesting things with the voice there. But his physicality is certainly, I think, what got him the role.
Sure.
Because he also does, he did Silver Surfer in the Tim Story Fantastic Four movie, like that. And Mike Mignola, yeah, has a fascinating career. His art style is so distinctive. His DC and Marvel work is great as well. I mean, while he'll always be known for the Hellboy universe, there's just a lot of great work out there. The Gotham by Gaslight Batman comic is a great one, too. But yeah. So, yeah, Abe Sapien is my number three as far as most relatable, most iconic, and again, it was cool that this is one, even though it's an independent comic, it also has a very cemented place in the wider pop culture sphere, thanks to the Del Toro adaptation and a couple other movies too, but the Del Toro ones are the top tier for me. So
cool.
Awesome. Well, Andy, what is now your number two pick for most relatable, most iconic indie comic book character?
Yeah, so for number two, I went with Susan Ptolemy from the book Giant Days by John Allison and originally Lissa Tremaine and then later Max Sarin for much of the run. So this is a British comic book set. It's more of a slice of life, like real-ish world comic about three young women at university. So, you know, it goes through, you know, their 3 years at university in the UK, and then they graduate, and that's the end of the book. So, it has a nice kind of, it's like 50-ish issues. There's three, you know, broken into three-year chunks. And, yeah, just about, you know, the ups and downs of their lives as university students. And of the three, so Susan there's Esther de Groot, who is the dramatic, gothy, you know, performance art and visual arts student. There is Daisy, I'm blanking on her last name, but Daisy is the sort of more...
It's been a minute since I don't remember the characters' names, but it's a great book, though.
Yeah, Daisy is more kind of craftsy and outdoorsy. Yeah, so there's Esther, there's Daisy, and then Susan is kind of the point of view character a little bit. She's a pre-med student, the sort of more level-headed one. She has a background in other John Allison books as sort of a detective. And yeah, so between that sort of like detective-y problem-solving, pragmatic kind of nature and her affinity for, you know, the health sciences, that was why I most connected with her. Obviously there are lots of differences between she and I, but I thought it was useful to not just bring in male characters to this conversation. And, you know, Giant Days is just one of my top, if not my favorite independent comic books. So I wanted to get some representation in there somehow. And so, you know, I'm definitely not a McGraw, the mechanical engineer who is very good at building and carpentry and all that kind of stuff. That is and was not me in university. I had to go with Susan. Some people might say I'm a bit more of an Ed, and I could see that. But you got to pick one of the main characters from the book, right? It's a really fun story. It's very comedic. It also, there's some serious drama at times as well. But the art is just amazing in terms of the facial comedy and the physical comedy. Every page kind of tells a story. Almost every panel is its own kind of joke or story beat or whatever. Just a very well crafted comic, entertaining all throughout. And yeah, even if you were not a young woman in university in the UK in the early 2000s, you can probably find a lot to enjoy from this book.
Excellent pick. Giant Days is one that a comic book writer friend of mine got me into years ago. And like you said, it's so fascinating to have this slice of life book that's not sci-fi or fantasy, that is, done in this medium so well. The art is fantastic. It's wonderfully relatable characters. And it is one of those. Really, I think even within comic circles, it's kind of a hidden gem. Like, I mean, it's won a bunch of awards and everything, but it's like, even people who read comics every week might not have ever heard of it or picked it up. And it's just one of those that, it should be studied in schools, I think. I mean, it's just like for anyone who says like, thinks comics is all superheroes and whatnot, like this is a perfect anecdote to that, saying like, no, here's a very grounded slice of life book that uses the medium so well to tell this story. Excellent pick. And like you said too, it's like, I mean, for the characters to be relatable, it doesn't have to be the same gender or experience as you. You can find elements of a character's story that you connect with. And that actually said, is there anything else you want to say on this? Because that actually segues into mine very nicely.
I'll just add that there was an extra layer of connection when my daughter went to high school and formed a trio of very close friends who mapped quite neatly to Esther, Susan, and Daisy. I won't embarrass her by saying which one was which, but that was an extra level of amusement to kind of have my own Susan, Esther, and Daisy wandering in and out of my house and my life for a few years there.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great connection. I love the, it's just such a cool thing about storytelling in general is the way we can find those moments and those stages in life that we have that connect directly to another character's story. But yeah, awesome. Well, Andy, excellent pick. And again, this segues actually very nicely into my number two pick, talking about someone who is not only from a very different world than me and also not the same gender, age, anything, but I alluded to Saga earlier and, you and I have discussed this book before on a comic book catch-up episode, but the character of Hazel, who is the main point of view character, is someone I actually find iconic and relatable in a unique way because for those, who've not read Saga or you probably heard the title if you're, been in comic shops in the last 15 years or so. But Saga is an epic sci-fi fantasy from Fiona Staples and Brian K. Vaughan. And it tells the story of Hazel is the point of view character and she's narrating the story of her life. And she grows up as the child of two star-crossed lovers from warring civilizations. Her parents were really forbidden to be with each other in a classic Romeo and Juliet sense. And their civilizations have been at war for over a century. And she is this child who was born and immediately hated for her existence. And while I do not have that experience at all, I want to point that out that I'm not the child of parents from warring civilizations. And I don't have anything like that. I come from a very loving family and my parents are still together. But the reason I bring this character up as someone relatable is because the beautiful thing about Saga is that while it takes place in this epic fantasy sci-fi world, it's very much has this way of mirroring the world in our world in many ways. So in terms of socio-political issues and in terms of the way people relate to each other and the way people can despise each other and how conflicts that really have no justification go on forever. You know, all of that is in Saga, and it makes it all the more human and all the more relatable. And so for me, Hazel feels like a millennial in many ways, of just like a child who is thrust into this world that is seemingly always on fire. And there are these, you know, global, or in her case, intergalactic conflicts that are never ending, and that leaders try to justify all the time, but that they're ultimately they're just the result of bigotry and, you know, selfish ideologies. And I mean, that wherever you stand politically, I think it's fair to say we live in a world where that's very much apparent. I mean, as a millennial who I was a kid when 9/11 happened, and, you know, and have, you know, there's been numerous tragedies on a global scale throughout my lifetime. So between 9/11, the pandemic, various turmoil, both, you know, in the U.S. and in the world as a whole, it definitely impacts how you grow up, and it impacts, you know, the way you see the world. And reading Saga, that for me is what, like, I can relate to Hazel the most, because she's a child who, you know, her life is dictated by so many other forces at work, and ultimately civilizations who hate each other because they feel like they have to. And it's just like, and you're longing for a better world for her and for her family and for everyone else and all these characters you come to love. But they're constantly offset by tragedy and, you know, conflicts that are never ending and escalating. And so, yeah, it's a, you know, in some way that might be a like weird connection, but also I think that's, again, the beauty of Saga is it does this big, you know, epic story, but it's ultimately grounded in a lot of the experiences that we have as humans. And you don't have to be in an intergalactic conflict to see how the themes of this book resonate. And so Hazel is just a very grounded, down-to-earth character. And it really helps that you have her voice narrating the story from the beginning, from issue one. And it's funny too, because a lot of times I'm not as big on voiceover narration. Like, even when I write scripts of my own or stories, I try to avoid that. But this is one case where it works really well, and you get that excellent point of view from her, and it adds so much depth and so much characterization. So that's just for me, Hazel is the biggest connection to millennial readers. Speaking as someone who is 32, grown up with all this stuff, I see a lot of the ways she feels in ways I felt and ways I've grown up.
Yeah, that's really cool. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, you know, we've talked about Saga before. You know, it is one of, you know, the books. It doesn't need a whole lot of promotion, I don't think, among comic book readers. But yeah, you know, it is very well done. As you were talking, I was reminded Rick Remender wrote an essay in the back of Escape Number One, his mm-hmm. recent book that is basically a World War II type story, but with anthropomorphic animals as the characters. And he wrote about, you know, how, you know, depicting these events and these people as you know, human-like animals, you know, think like Thundercats kind of thing, right? That creates some distance between the reader and the character that allows them to maybe see things about themselves that they wouldn't if, you know, the person on the page fit neatly into a pre-existing bucket, right? Either a group that you like or a group that you don't like or what have you, right? But we project all kinds of things onto people because we put them into certain buckets right away. And when you're, you know, looking at a character that you just don't have a bucket for, it creates that distance that allows you to maybe see things a little bit differently. And, you know, it's hard to get much more different than, you know, a race of people who have television monitors for heads. And, you know, and I can definitely, as you were talking about Saga, like I hadn't made that connection before consciously. But, you know, everything that Remender wrote in that essay could 100% apply to Saga. And I'm sure that is, you know, a big part of what Vaughn and Staples are, you know, why it is created the way that it is, whether they were totally conscious of the same things that he was talking about or not. you know, it's clearly one of the benefits or the merits of that book is the way that it allows you to examine the real world without the entanglements of all of the real world identities and ideologies.
100%. I mean, yeah, like comics aren't just escapism. I think they're a way for, like any storytelling medium, like good storytelling allows you to have more empathy for other people and to kind of examine yourself, examine your own mindset, examine the way you see other people. And yeah, I think Saga does a beautiful job of that with its multi-layered storytelling, its multi-layered characters. And yeah, so this is just one that, you know, it really resonated with me. I still love the book. And yeah, I think Hazel has been there obviously from issue one. And I think for me continues to be the most powerful, relatable character. And, you know, should be right up there with Batman and Superman in terms of, you know, most iconic comic book characters of all time.
Mm-hmm.
So awesome. Well, Andy, I'm very excited to hear your number one pick here for most relatable, most iconic comic book character from the indie comic book world.
Yeah. So I said that, you know, I didn't imprint on most of his characters as a kid, but I had to think a little bit about my childhood. So I went with a character who you know, comes from the comic books, but my introduction, like yours with Abe Sapien, was in a different medium, that of the Saturday morning television cartoon. And I am, of course, referring to Donatello of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. So, you know, the Ninja Turtles, you know, created as comic book characters by Kevin Eastman and Peter Laird. I was not cool enough as an 8 or 9 year old or whatever age I was when those books started first coming out to be reading black and white independent comics of, you know, for probably more mature readers. But I was, you know, cool enough to watch the Ninja Turtles on Saturday morning. And so, yeah, that got me hooked. I wouldn't say that I've followed the Turtles, you know, consistently or religiously since then. I've dipped in and out. I have read, you know, gone back and read some of the comics. There's lots of comics and I haven't gotten to all of them yet. But, you know, obviously they are formative. You know, that was definitely a significant moment in independent comics, you know, that this book from nowhere became a very popular cartoon show, lineup of action figures, movies, live action movies, animated movies, video games. You know, I still have very fond memories of the afternoon that my friends and I rented Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 4, the time travel one, Turtles Through Time, I think it is, for the Super NES, and went to my friend's house who had a Super NES, and I'm pretty sure we just sat down and played through the whole game in a Saturday afternoon. We certainly got very far with it if we didn't. But yeah, so, you know, they're just kind of a fun bit of my childhood. And, you know, Donatello, you know, so... you know, I don't think this started with the 80s, but I think the 80s cartoons certainly refined the formula of, you know, you create a team and you give everybody kind of a very particular personality, set of characteristics, right? And so all these teams had to have, like, the smart one, the science one, whatever, you know, and who was the tech wizard or the computer wizard or the science wizard or whatever. And, you know, for the Ninja Turtles, that was Donatello. And, you know, that was kind of, you know, my introduction to, I wouldn't say that the Ninja Turtles specifically were my introduction to, but those kind of characters, you know, that I kept getting drawn to those characters, you know, there's an interesting chicken and egg question of, is that why I was interested in science or because I was interested in science, I was drawn to those characters. But there was definitely an affinity there that you know, continued to grow over time. And I, you know, kept kind of gravitating towards, oh, if there's a science one or, you know, something like that, that was the character that I would latch onto. And, you know, Donatello was the first and one of the standout ones there. So, yeah, I mean, you know, the Ninja Turtles, you know, on the cartoon, you know, not the deepest personalities, not the most complex stories, but, you know, for a kid, you know, a story about brotherhood and friendship and, you know, navigating the prejudices of the world. Right. I mean, the Ninja Turtles were also kind of in that defending a world that fears and hates them kind of category. And so, you know, there were some definitely some good values there. And, you know, there's this internet meme of As a child, I expected that more of my adult life would involve quicksand and some of these other things, you know, the tropes from stories that turned out to not be such a big deal in life. I think I'm realizing, as I was reflecting on for this episode and reflecting on the turtles, I think I realized that one of the things I expected from my childhood to be a bigger deal in adult life was being a part of some kind of squad or team where everybody had, you know, perfectly complementary skills and personalities, and we all worked together to accomplish missions. Missions have been a much smaller part of my adult life than I expected based on childhood of, you know, Ninja Turtles and A-Team and Knight Rider and Rescue Rangers and, you know, all those kinds of things. Yeah, just not enough missions as an adult. I think maybe that's why I like escape rooms. I think that's the closest to going on a Saturday morning mission kind of adventure is doing an escape room. So anyway, that was a little bit of a tangent, but yeah, that's my number one, Donatello of the Ninja Turtles.
I mean, hey, Andy, you could count this podcast as group missions here where we have our own personalities. I try to relate at work too, because, well, I'll go ahead and say, so you and I think alike here. While I did not back the exact same turtle, although Donatello is like close second for me. But this was also, the turtles came to mind also for similar reasons as you. I grew up on, I think each one, depending on like when you grew up, we kind of all have our eras of turtles we grew up in. For me, it was the early 2000s animated series that was a classic. I mean, I think it ran on Fox, if I'm not mistaken. It was that and then the 90s movies. So those were my introductions. But for me, Leonardo is my guy. I love all of them. But I don't know if it was, there were many reasons I think I gravitated toward the character. It was, I mean, blue is my favorite color. I like, and just from a like, when I had all the action figures, I liked Leo the best because he had the swords. I just thought that was cool. And so there were a lot of, but he's also, yeah, I mean, he's obviously the group leader, but I kind of see him and Mikey as, but you know, in many ways, like they both kind of lead. Ralph. I mean, yeah, Mikey, that would be a little too much, but him and Ralph kind of have the like, sort of tug of war a lot of times for leadership of the turtles. And Ralph is more hot-headed, but they also need each other, him and Leo. And what I liked, I think, most about Leonardo, again, watching him in the 90s movies, watching him in the early 2000s animated series, later on reading the comics, is that, you know, he has this instinct as a leader, but he's also not perfect. He, you know, he knows when he makes mistakes. He, and ultimately he, you know, feels the burden too of leadership in many ways. And, he is always going to, Splinter for, advice and, you know, that mentorship. And, but yeah, I mean, the turtles are just, they're so relatable and so cool for kids across, but for adults too. I mean, the cool thing is, you know, being able to read the comics as adult, because a lot of them, especially Last Ronin, not exactly a kid's book. It has a lot of like darker themes in there. And yeah, that's what I love about these characters is they are one group where I feel like I've grown up with them. They're a big part of my childhood. But they've also, you know, had this long lasting legacy for many generations. And yeah, Leo was just always one I really related to. I thought was really cool. I love all of them, and I like all the different personality traits they have. Donatello being the most intelligent of them, and very wise, and also really cool. Mikey being the goofy kind of more party animal, and Ralph being a little more hot headed, but also the one that will, you know, never let anything happen to his brothers, and will fight to the last minute. And so, you know, I love all of them for different reasons, but yeah, I mean, Turtles was just like quintessential. I still remember getting the figures at Toys R Us. For kids listening, Toys R Us was the store you actually went to go buy toys from. You didn't get everything online back in those days. But yeah, it was quite a time. And I mean, I had the movies like on VHS, you know, those were just a key part of my childhood. So, Yeah, I love that we both picked. As soon as you started talking Colonel, I was like, okay, you picked Colonel too. I had a feeling you picked Donatello because I think every academic gravitates toward Donatello the most. But yeah, and Leo kind of has that both of like intelligence and he can fight and, you know, and like, but, you know, has his own immaturities he wrestles with as well. I liked all the different layers to his character.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a good one. But yeah, also the fun thing about that, the 2000s animated series was it was notorious for every episode would end with to be continued.
Okay.
It was very much structured in that way. But the animation's great. That's where I had all the figures from. It had Casey, April, Shredder, all that. A lot of favorite turtle stories out there. I also, since I'm wearing a Batman shirt, I love the Batman TMNT book is, and the animated movies are excellent.
Sure, yeah. So is that your pick as Leonardo from the Turtles? That is funny.
He is my number one. Yep, yep. So we both ended on a Turtles high for this one. But yeah,
excellent.
Yeah. So this was a blast, Andy. I really enjoyed hearing your picks, and I think we could go. You know, there's so many more we could go for. You know, and like I said too earlier, there are a lot of books where in the indie world that I love, but you know, and iconic characters, but not necessarily ones I relate to. And also a lot of big indie comics that like, I mean, I've read some of, but I have a Spawn figure on my wall, but I haven't read a ton of Spawn. I just, you know, it's just a iconic character, and I like the figure up on the wall there with some other horror stuff. But yeah, there's a lot of the 90s Image stuff I've dabbled in, but I haven't really read as much. Again, I came on more from the like 2012 and up era. And some books too, like, I mean, they're more limited series or, you know, they may run like, you know, 25, 30 issues. So it's not like a big ongoing that runs 300 issues or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the indie comics world, you know, there's a million things we could have talked about. You know, I was thinking about Will Eisner's The Spirit, right? A seminal early work in comics. You know, my daughter took a trip to France with her high school class and went to the Asterisk and Obelix theme park over there, right? So those are two, I don't know if they're French or Belgian French comic book characters, you know, that are like the biggest thing in Europe in terms of independent comics. You've got all the manga, right? There's lots of stories. Mm-hmm. The breadth of this kind of thing is quite substantial.
Oh, and manga, like manga is not even one I've delved into, not because I have any like disdain for the medium. It's just like it's intimidating how much there is out there. But yeah, we have if you're a manga fan, we have a feature on Systematic Ecology called Manga Mustard. So you can some of our hosts are big enthusiasts there.
Yeah. So if we left out your favorite indie comic character, it is not a slight. It is just that, you know, if you only can pick three, there's a lot of they're going to get left behind. So please join us in the comments of the video or on the Discord or somewhere and share yours as well, because there's lots of worthy characters and books out there.
Absolutely. And we do have a bonus question for Patreon subscribers. So you'll hear after. And if you want to support our Patreon, the bonus question will be what is an indie comic book or a character that maybe isn't relatable, but still iconic and still that you gravitate toward. So we'll be talking about that in the bonus round. But yeah, Andy, this has been an absolute blast. I really enjoyed hearing your picks. And yeah, it was fun kind of talking comics that aren't the big two, but certainly, you know, a lot of great stories out there. So this was, thank you for joining me here.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a fun conversation. It was fun to hear what you picked, and I'm glad that we are united in our Turtles enthusiasm.
Absolutely. Gotta love Turtle. Well, it was really funny too, because when I was making the list earlier, I was like, I was going through like Jeff Lemire titles and all, and then it just hit. I was like, duh, like Ninja Turtles. I started as an indie comic, but yeah. So they're like, great minds think alike here.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, awesome. Well, for our listeners out there, thank you so much for joining. Again, tell your friends and family about us. Like, rate, subscribe, review. It really helps us out. And remember, we are all a chosen people, a geekdom of priests.
Thank you all so much for your time listening to this episode. If you want to help sponsor our show, but you can't quite do the membership thing, commit to that once a month payment, good news, you can leave a donation on our Fourth Wall website. You also can get some free content over there. So if you don't have the money for the membership, but you still want to hear some of the extras and bonuses we do over on Fourth Wall, there's an option for that. If you want to support the show without that commitment every month, again, you can donate over there. Every little bit helps. You know, our show has a lot of needs when it comes to equipment, when it comes to going to some of the events we want to go to, advertising, getting the word out about our show. It takes a lot, and we really appreciate each and every person who's able to help us do it, even if it's something free, just like the free membership or leaving a rate and review on our site. Every little bit helps. Your time listening to this helps, and we appreciate all of you. We're so proud of the community we formed over at Systematic Ecology, and we're very happy and we're proud that you're a part of it. Thank you so much for your time and for being a part of this community.
Hello there, listener. Thanks for listening. This is Evan Garcia. I hope you enjoyed this episode. We just wanted to come in and remind you that this episode is part of a bigger network of podcasts called the Anazal Podcast Network. We have great shows like the Whole Church Podcast, Kung Fu Pizza Party, and the Homily with Pastor Chill Will. Chill Will, the podcast has sermons from our host, Pastor Will. Great sermons every time. The Kung Fu Pizza Party is Brandon Knight showing his expertise and his passion for everything Kung Fu films. And he dispenses a bunch of wisdom. Great show. And the Whole Church Podcast, where Josh and TJ interview people from different denominations and church traditions to pursue greater church unity. It's a great podcast to see what other denominations are included. And we just want to say thank you so much for listening. See you next time.